Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. After one of our craziest weeks ever here on the Issue Is, that trip to Washington, D.C. with Governor Newsom, this week we calmed things down a bit. We're back with the governor, though, for a big bill signing, which is something he previewed on our show last week. This bill where he takes on ghost guns. So we're going to start off the show with a report about that event. Then we're going to talk to Bob Hertzberg, state senator, also candidate for supervisor. And a little later, we'll hear from Adam Schiff, the member of the January 6th committee. And we'll wrap up with some comments from Ron DeSantis reacting to our interview last week. Let's begin, though, with a report about Governor Newsom's big bill signing.
And enshrine this bill into law in the state of California.
California Governor Gavin Newsom is the first governor in America to sign a bill that creates a right for private citizens to sue those who manufacture, distribute, transport, import into California illegal weapons.
Perhaps is the most impactful thing we have done in decades.
Wow, that's pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Mia Treta gets a copy of the bill. In 2019, she was a freshman at Saugus High School along with her best friend Dominic Blackwell when they were both shot. Dominic died. Mia barely survived.
Governor Newsom visited me in the hospital after the shooting. He asked if there was anything he can do. Well, sir, you are doing it. You, Governor Newsom, are saving lives.
Governor Newsom tears up after hearing from Mia.
Sorry, guys. Thanks, Mia.
Governor Newsom signs this bill, written by Senator Bob Hertzberg, at Santa Monica College, where in 2013, five innocent people were killed by a gunman using an untraceable weapon. Mia was also shot by an illegal gun.
These weapons that were once seen as the weapon of choice for terrorists and criminals have started showing up in the hands of children and teens.
Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court did not stop Texas from going forward with a law that allows private citizens to seek $10,000 from those providing abortions. In California, starting January 1st, residents can seek $10,000 per illegal gun.
It's time to put them on the defense. We are sick and tired of being on the defense in this movement.
Newsom says this isn't a Second Amendment violation because the Second Amendment protects legal gun ownership, and this only goes after illegal guns.
It's Independence Day.
On July 4th, Governor Newsom ran an ad in Florida blasting their Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. On this day, he paid for this ad in Texas's newspapers, attacking their Republican governor, Greg Abbott, over guns. On Capitol Hill last week, Newsom told me he talked about this strategy with Democratic senators like Chris Murphy. And that's just the start.
Democratic governors from around the country are here in California for a big meeting. Is this something that you're going to bring up with them as something that could be a model in other states going forward?
Absolutely. I'll be talking to close to a dozen governors later this afternoon, this evening, and tomorrow. I will be highlighting this specifically in my remarks.
Mia is now a committed activist who recently met with President Biden at the White House. She's grateful for California's leadership.
This is progress that we've all been waiting for.
She is really something. 17 years old. How about that? All right. Now we move on to an interview with Senator Bob Hertzberg at that event. He, of course, wrote that bill, walked out hand in hand with Governor Newsom, or arm in arm, I should say. And he is running for supervisor of L.A. County, one of the most powerful jobs. Sheila Kuehl's retiring. He's the front runner to replace her. More conservative than Sheila Kuehl. So here's our interview with Bob Hertzberg.
It's another very important step to try to reduce gun violence. And it also ties together the court case and by the Supreme Court on abortion in Texas. And it basically says, well, if it's good for Texas, it's for abortions, we'll use the same standards here. And so as the court moves in a different direction, we have to be nimble and innovative and creative as a state. And if they're going to say they're going to give us more rights, we're going to take them in the direction that we want to take them.
The governor is essentially saying to all 40 million Californians, have your way.
go do this. Where does the $10,000 come from?
Well, it's in the bill. We wrote it down. And it's, by the way, what he didn't say, which is important, it's $10,000 per gun. So if you find somebody with five ghost guns, that's $50,000 that you can win in an award. And so, look, is it
not from taxpayers, essentially?
No. From the person who owns the guns. It's an award. It's a private action. It's not a court case by the government. It's not the Attorney General or the state of California bringing the action. If you, for example, Aaron, wanted to go and saw somebody, you could sue and recover $50,000 plus attorney's fees.
So January 1st, people can start going for this. Let's talk about the other thing that you're doing right now, which is running for LA County Supervisor. Big stories on that front right now is this idea of an indoor mask mandate potentially returning to LA County. Barbara Ferrer, the health director, appears to think that that's a good idea when every other health director in the entire state has chosen not to do that. Do you think that an indoor mask mandate makes sense?
Well, I'll tell you, I'd take a much slower approach to it. I talked to my doctor and asked my doctor when I had a physical last week, what do you think about this? And she goes, she thought it was a little bit overmuch. I've called some friends at hospitals, at different hospitals. I said, how many people, just on my own, asking around, do you have any people in their ICUs, one here, none here, and the like?
I mean, as a board of supervisors, you are in charge of hiring or firing the health director.
That's correct.
Do you think that Barbara Ferrer is doing a good job? Does she have your confidence?
I don't know enough to know. I don't think it's appropriate. I'm not as these politicians who stick finger in people's eyes and cause press conferences, scream at people. I find ways to work with folks, but I wouldn't know one way or the other.
What do you mean you don't know? I mean, isn't that one of the most important people in the whole county?
It is, but it just seems to me, I'm a candidate. I'm not inside the board. I don't have all the information that they have, right? I'd like to talk to her and learn and find out what her basis is and cross-question her and ask the hard questions.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Another tough question is recall potential of George Gascon.
Right.
What do you make of that? Do you think that's a good idea? Are you supportive of that?
I'm not somebody who generally likes recalls. I didn't support him because he wasn't supportive of me on certain issues on bail and other things. I didn't support him. And he clearly made a promise to do what he's doing, and he's doing it. People are pissed. And the communities that I am looking to represent and the communities I represent now are pissed about how he does stuff. But let's see what happens if they get the votes and what makes the determination. Again, we'll see if the numbers count up and what that looks like.
What do you think is the biggest difference between you and your opponent if you actually get on the board?
Well, I think I'm comfortable in my skin. I know who I am. I've been in and out of government. I've been in private sector for a long time, taking a company public. And I would suggest that being speaker and majority leader isn't just somebody who deals with small stuff. I have to deal with Republicans. I have to deal with Democrats. I have to deal with the governor. I have to deal with every interest group to come up with solutions. I'm not just somebody who gets up in a podium and makes speeches or in a small city that is 1.9 square miles. I have dealt with every single issue that the county deals with.
Our thanks to Bob Hertzberg. We move on now to the issue of January 6th. This week, another hearing, another conversation with Congressman Adam Schiff. Let's begin with some of Donald Trump from this week's videos.
But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
During an outtake from a White House video, President Trump refused to say the election was over, even though his staff clearly wanted him to. This was one of the revelations from the latest January 6th committee hearing. Adam Schiff is a member of that committee. He's a Democrat from Burbank. Congressman, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Good to be with you.
What is the biggest takeaway from this week's hearing?
I think the biggest takeaway is that for over 3 hours, while that violent attack is going on, that mob that the president discharged at the Capitol, knowing it was armed, for 3 hours, he sat there in the dining room. He watched it happen. His friends, his family, even conservative commentators on TV, calling, texting, urging him to do something to stop it, and he won't. He doesn't call the Secretary of Defense. He doesn't call the Secretary of Homeland Security. He doesn't call anyone to put an end to it for over 3 hours. And I can't imagine a more profound dereliction of duty by a commander-in-chief than that.
And it was striking how many people on the president's own team wanted him to call off the mob. Here's an exchange that gets at that point between White House counsel Pat Cipollone, you, and Liz Cheney. Listen in.
I can't think of anybody, on that day who didn't want people to get out of the Capitol once the, you know, particularly once the violence started. No. I mean,
what about the president?
Yeah.
She said the staff. So I answered.
No, I said in the White House.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you said who else on the staff.
What was your reaction to that, and what was going through his mind?
Well, you know, he then invoked privilege so as not to have to answer the question. But the question was pretty well answered by, I think, his unwillingness to say, and the actual testimony of other witnesses, that the president believed that Mike Pence essentially had it coming. He wasn't going to stop this mob. And finally, when he was prevailed upon to do or say something, it was only after the FBI and the military were responding to the scene and he understood that this violent effort to interfere with the transfer of power was going to fail. It was only then he was moved to do or say anything about it.
Another moment that really stood out was when White House or former White House strategist Steve Bannon laid all of this out as a strategy days before the election even happened. This is what he said in late October of 2020.
Also, if Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it. If Biden's winning, Trump is going to do some crazy.
So late this week, Bannon was convicted for contempt of Congress. What's your reaction to that and to his role in all of this?
Well, my reaction to his conviction is that justice was done. You can't simply refuse to show up and testify when you're subpoenaed by Congress, the court, or anyone else. And the kind of arrogance that he was displaying, no, I don't have to, because basically he's a friend of the former president and thinks he's beyond the law. Well, he's not. And the jury just made it that abundantly clear to him. In terms of what you just heard him say in that recording, this was the president's plan from the beginning. He knew, for example, that the late votes coming in, the absentee votes, were going to run against him. So he first urged them to stop counting votes because he knew that those votes would go against them. And he was prepared, no matter what happened, if he didn't win, to claim that it must be fraud, it must be rigged. Bannon is just saying the silent thing out loud, and it's disgraceful.
I know it is the Justice Department's role to charge Donald Trump with a crime. I know you don't want to tell the Justice Department what to do, but you also understand the law really well. You're a former prosecutor. If President Trump was charged with a crime, what potential crime is there that he could be charged with? What is even a possibility?
Well, the number of offenses that he may have committed in connection with these multiple lines of effort to overturn the election. Judge Carter, a federal judge in California who has analyzed this, found multiple statutes, a conspiracy to defraud the United States. He found that there was evidence that the president was involved in a plot to obstruct the lawful functions of the Congress, that is the joint session. He didn't even get to, I think, the circumstances around the violent attack on the Capitol, but there may be other crimes associated with that, given what we now know about his mental state. That is, he intended for that crowd to go to the Capitol, and he knew they were armed. He knew they were angry because he'd made them angry. So it could be any number of things. I do think that there's certainly sufficient evidence that we have put forward to merit an investigation of the president. As you say, the Justice Department will make that decision. It's another question about whether there's enough to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, but there's certainly, I believe, enough to begin the investigation.
And there's a question about whether Merrick Garland believes that should be the role to, you know, indict a former president, too. Does he have the stomach for that, which some on the left are questioning? We will see. But let's talk about the way that people on the right are reacting to this. We got some Republican reaction when we were on Capitol Hill last week. We spoke with Daryl Issa from San Marcos. I want you to listen into his response to my question about the committee.
The hearings are a missed opportunity because they're one-sided, because they've deliberately left out any kind of cross-examination or presentation, they're losing the credibility. And it's a shame because really bad things happen on January 6th and people need to be held accountable.
What do you say to all the Republicans who have tuned out from these hearings because they feel like they're not represented?
Well, the Republicans from Kevin McCarthy on down rejected an independent commission that would have been made up equally of Democrats and Republicans. So it's a bit rich to say, well, you know, don't pay attention to what this committee is showing because it's not an independent commission when they rejected that. What's more, the witnesses that we're calling in are almost all Republicans. In fact, one of my favorite editorial cartoons is a picture of Kevin McCarthy saying, these hearings are not fair. They're so partisan. All the witnesses are Republican. And that just, I think, highlights the absurdity of that argument.
What more is there to say? Are the people that are for you with you at this point and the people that are for him not listening to you at this point? How long does this go on for?
Well, I think that brings up an important point, which is we're trying to reach all of those with an open mind in the country, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, independents, or members of any other political persuasion. We want to get the facts out there. And, you know, I'll tell you, I wouldn't expect to hear differently from a Republican member of Congress who lives in fear of Donald Trump. But when I talk to Republicans out in my district, out in airports around the country, they are impressed with what they're seeing in the committee. They like it, frankly, that Democrats and Republicans on our committee are working together without acrimony to get at the truth. And a lot of them are thanking me for the hearings, and then they will add in a kind of a hushed tone, and I'm a Republican.
So what are we looking for in September?
Well, in September, you know, I think we will hold additional hearings to present whatever new information we have accumulated. We continue to have people coming forward. Importantly, we're going to be working on our report and proposing legislation to try to protect the country from any kind of a repetition of what we saw on January 6th. And that's really our predominant function. It's not to prosecute people. That's the Justice Department's role. But we want to hopefully legislate in a way that prevents this from ever happening again.
And we know that the Senate is also working on bipartisan legislation to change the Electoral Count Act, which would literally prevent something like this from happening again the next time around on January 6th. Congressman, you know, we always like to end with something fun. The last time you were on our show, it was your birthday week, and you told us that your wife was getting you tickets to Kill a Mockingbird as a birthday present. Did you go? How was the show?
I went. It was great.
Was Atticus a big inspiration for you as a kid?
He was. That film and his role is what made me want to become a lawyer. And I know that's true of a great many lawyers of my generation. They were so inspired by his role to want to pursue that line of work.
Our thanks to Congressman Schiff. Let's end this week with an update from our big interview last week, including a clip of it on This Week.
Gavin Newsom may be the only guy that Biden's willing to deport.
I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. I've tried to say no, no way, in every way I possibly can. It's just fodder. It's made up, and it is, frankly, it's not helpful.
Some early chatter already underway for the 2024 presidential race.
Our interview with Governor Newsom was featured on ABC's This Week and dozens of news outlets around the country, from Fox News Channel to MSNBC. One person who heard about it was Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis. Remember on July 4th, the governor aired this ad in Florida saying that California's is more free than Florida? Newsom told us that he was outraged by DeSantis's decision to potentially fine the Special Olympics for trying to implement a vaccine mandate in Florida. Here's some of our conversation. Have you ever met Ron DeSantis or talked to him?
No.
What would you say to him?
You know, stop being a bully. Stop belittling people that look differently, act differently, love differently. Who the hell are you? Stop.
Well, this week, DeSantis was interviewed by Brendan Leslie on a conservative-leaning show called Florida's Voice. And he quoted DeSantis part of our interview.
This is a guy that locked people down, that kept kids out of school, denied people the right to earn a living, wanted to force COVID vaxes on people, What did I do? I stood in the way of all that. I lifted people up. We stood with students against the teachers union. We stood with individuals against big government. And we made sure that people had the choice about whether they wanted to take this vax or not. They should not have ever been in a position to lose their job. He also attacked me for helping these Special Olympic athletes. These athletes they have Down syndrome, disabilities, and they wanted to compete in the Special Olympics in Orlando. Well, there's an international bureaucracy affiliated with the group that imposed vax discrimination on these athletes. A lot of the athletes I met, their doctors told them not to do it based on their condition. So what did we do? We fought the bureaucracy and we got those athletes reinstated. That changed their lives to be able to do. He would discriminate against athletes with Down syndrome.
How about that from Governor DeSantis? Our thanks to all of our guests this week. We really appreciate hearing lots of different perspectives here on The Issue Is. We thank you for listening. Hope that you'll like and subscribe and send us your feedback in social media. Until next time, I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening.